This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on third semester of New Testament Greek. This is session number 10 on mood.
The last feature of the verb that we want to cover is mood. And so we've talked about tense or aspect, and we've considered number and person and voice. And the last one that we want to look at is mood. Now, by mood, we don't mean how the author was feeling or whether he's in a good mood or bad mood or happy or sad, although any of those could have been the case. But by mood, in grammatical terms, we're referring to the author's attitude towards the action as far as whether he is making an assertion or not. And so one way to look at the moods, we'll see that there are four moods that we want to focus on in the Greek New Testament. And one way to consider them together and divide them up is whether the mood makes an assertion about reality, about the nature of the action, or non-assertion. So assertion or non-assertion, is the author asserting something about the relationship of the action to reality, or is the author not making an assertion? The assertive mood would be the indicative mood. The indicative mood is the mood the author uses to simply make assertions or ask questions. And we won't talk a lot about the indicative mood because in the same way that we said the aorist tense is sort of the default aspect and the active voice, the direct causality, the active voice is kind of the default voice, the indicative mood is the default mood. It's the standard mood the author's going to use when he's just making assertions, making statements, narrating events, asking questions. It's a standard mood. And again, statistically, the indicative mood is by far the most common occurring mood in the New Testament. Under non-assertion, there are three moods. One of them is the subjunctive mood. The other one is the optative mood. And then finally, the imperative mood. And we'll kind of cover these moods in two different lessons. But again, to emphasize, the indicative mood then is the most common mood, and it could be called the mood of assertion. Some people call it the mood of reality, and that's fine as long as we don't confuse the idea that whenever the indicative mood is being used, it's indicating that the action is real. That's often true. But sometimes you'll find Satan telling a lie in the indicative mood. That doesn't mean it's real. So the idea is that the indicative mood is used when the author is simply making assertions or asking questions. And again, it's the common standard mood. And so it's probably the mood that you will not make, when it comes to exegesis or studying the Greek New Testament, you will not make a big deal out of it or spend a lot of time on the indicative mood. It's when the author departs from that and uses some of the other moods that you need to sit up and take notice and pay close attention. So let's talk a little bit about these moods. Again, we'll kind of start to narrow down. Another way to look at the moods, as far as their meaning overall, is the indicative mood, again, is the mood of assertion. The author is making assertion, making statements, asking questions. The subjunctive mood can be seen as the mood of projection. The author is simply projecting an action as capable of being realized, something that could take place. Whether it is or not, or whether it will or not, whether it's likely or probable or unlikely, that information only comes from the context. And sometimes you'll find language in other grammars discussing the subjunctive mood. It's the mood of probability, or it's more probable that this is going to take place. The problem with that is, in, for example, in 1 John 3, the second coming of Christ is described in a subjunctive mood. Is Christ probably going to come back? No, we know he is. It's just because it's still future, the author, for whatever reason, projects it as an action that's capable of being realized. I personally find that kind of language helpful for me in understanding the subjunctive. It presents an action as capable of realization. Whether it is definitely going to happen, whether it's probably or only possible or likely or unlikely, that can only come from the context. All that the subjunctive says is an action is projected as a possibility, as capable of being realized. And then how likely or unlikely, how probable or certain, that information comes only from the context and like our broader theological understanding of, for example, the coming of Christ. The optative mood, like the subjunctive, expresses projection, that is, an action is projected as a possibility, but it also has the added feature, hence the plus sign, of contingency. So it adds a notion of hesitancy or contingency to it. And you know, you can see in some of the usages that we'll look at that that appears to be, indeed be the case. Now, the optative mood is dying out, much like the pluperfect aspect was dying out in the New Testament, the optative mood as well. There's still examples of it, but the optative mood is on its way out. The most famous example of the optative mood that you're aware of is when Paul says, may it never be, may genoita. It's the aorist optative of genomai, negated by may. That actually accounts for a number of the usages of the optative mood in the Greek New Testament. So again, English translations handle that in different ways. But then the final mood is the imperative mood, and we could maybe say it is the mood of direction. The author is directing the action of his readers, and this would be the mood of command, imperatives, but the imperative mood, the mood of direction. And so we'll talk about these individually, and again, especially the imperative mood, and a couple of issues related to the indicative and subjunctive, conditional clauses. We'll deal with conditionals and the imperative mood in the next lecture. But I want to talk a little bit about the function, especially of the first three moods. All three of these moods, especially the indicative and subjunctive, we'll spend most time in those because, as I said, the optative mood is kind of dying out. One way to look at the indicative mood is, again, we've already said the indicative mood, the mood of assertion, is kind of the default mood. So, again, you won't spend a lot of time when it comes to exegesis. And once more, you often find grammars multiplying labels that describe how the indicative is used. And again, if you want to do that, that's fine. But I find it less helpful to linger on indicative mood because that's just the default standard mood the author is going to use. And it's when the author departs from that that you want to pay attention. But the indicative mood can be used in both main clauses and supporting, or We might call it subordinate clauses. The main clauses are the clauses that carry the main discourse along. And then supporting clauses modify that something in the main clauses. They further support them. They further modify them. They're subordinate to them. But the indicative verbs in the indicative mood can be used in main clauses or just supporting clauses. And this first one is easy. This is virtually anything in the Greek New Testament where you find a main primary clause and the verb is in the indicative mood. So there's not a whole lot to say about this use. But you also find it in subordinate clauses, supporting clauses. And one that we're going to look at later that sometimes is important is in conditional clauses. So if I were to say, to use an English example, if it is raining tomorrow, I will stay indoors. If it is raining is your conditional sentence. It's called the prodesis. Don't worry, we'll talk more about that. But that's the if part, and that's actually the subordinate clause. The main clause is, I will stay indoors. The subordinate supporting clause that could have an indicative verb would be, if it is raining. And it is raining, that would be your, raining would be your verb. Or if the weather turns bad, or if there is a thunderstorm, there the verb is would be in the indicative, and that would be a conditional clause. In Greek, we find an example that we'll turn back to. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus says, if I cast out demons using a plus a verb in the indicative, cast out. If I cast out demons in the name of Beelzebub, we'll come back to that. But that's an example of a first-class condition. Again, I want to come back to that. I'm just using language, hopefully, that you might be familiar with. But this is a use of the indicative verb in a subordinate or supporting clause, and a conditional clause in the New Testament. If I cast out demons by the name of Beelzebub, but if I cast out demons by the power of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. That's the main clause. The kingdom of God has come upon you. The subordinate one is, if I cast out demons by the power of the Spirit or by the power of God. That would be a plus an indicative verb, an example of the indicative used in a supporting clause. So I don't want to say a whole lot more about that. But one, because again, the indicative mood is the mood that is the most common used and is the default, and again, the one that you will not spend a lot of time on. But instead, I want to move on to the subjunctive mood. And one way to look at it is we can look at it also in terms of subjunctive verbs. Verbs in the subjunctive mood can be used in both main clauses. Again, these would be the main clauses that stand on their own and communicate on their own. Or it can be used in supporting or subordinate clauses. That is, these clauses don't stand by themselves, but they play a modifying role. They support, or they're subordinate to, or they modify something else in the discourse, often in the main clause. Now, when it comes to the main clause, one of the two of the most common usages of the subjunctive mood, and again, with both of these, we need to keep in mind the idea of the subjunctive mood is an action is projected as capable of realization. And again, how certain that might be, how unlikely, how likely, how probable, that information only comes from the context. But verbs in the subjunctive mood can be used in main clauses, and two usages that come under that that I want to focus on is one of them is in what is called a hortatory. A hortatory subjunctive. The idea of hortatory is in giving instruction, commanding. A hortatory subjunctive is a way for the author to implore his readers to join him in an action. And it functions like an imperative, like a command. The key feature to identifying these is they will usually be, and here we need to go back to our previous lecture and talk about person and number. They will be first person, and they will usually be plural. First person and plural. And the whole point is they will be a main verb in the main clause, and first person plural. When you see that, you very well may be looking at a hortatory subjunctive. And the way we translate it, we'll look at some examples. The way we usually translate it, we're often told to translate it, let us. You could also translate it, we should. But however you translate it, it's important to understand, it has the force of an imperative. It has the force of a command. It's not just a suggestion, or, you know, we ought to do this. Might be a good idea that we do this. It's more forceful than that. A really good example of a hortatory subjunctive. Actually, there's a number of them, but we won't focus on all of them. Is found in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews actually does have a number of hortatory subjunctives, and Hebrews chapter 4. As one example where the hortatory subjunctive occurs. Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 14 through 16. The author's been arguing for Jesus as our high priest and our representative, and now as the one who offers us a rest that we shouldn't miss, like the Israelites missed their rest because of obedience, and they rebelled when they first were brought up to the promised land. Now the readers of Hebrews are told not to, and part of the way that they can avoid this is by resting in and trusting in their high priest. So verse chapter 4 and verses 14 through 16, therefore, having a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us grasp our confession. So there's the first hortatory subjunctive. Again, I need to erase a lot of this. We're talking about the hortatory subjunctive, but the first one in Hebrews 4, 14 through 16, let us grasp. In verse 14, kratomen. Notice, here is your first person plural subjunctive ending. And it's a main clause, it's a verb in the main clause. So let us grasp, or we should grasp, we should hold on to our confession. For we do not have a high priest, verse 15, who is not able to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way according to our likeness, but without sin. Therefore, let us approach proskomatha. There's your first person plural subjunctive ending. And it's a main verb in the clause. So, and you find other examples like this in Hebrews, but here's two clear examples of hortatory subjunctives, and they tend to be very emphatic, and they tend to be prominent in the discourse. They tend to be important when you see them, because the author and his readers are both involved in the action. So, let us grasp, and let us, or we should grasp, we should approach the throne of grace to find help in time of need. We should approach our high priest. So examples of hortatory subjunctives. And you find them scattered around elsewhere in the New Testament. But Hebrews seems to have a number of hortatory subjunctives. But the key to identifying them is, number one, it'll be a main verb in a main clause. And number two, it will be first person plural, subjunctive. Good. Another use, just very briefly, another use of the subjunctive mood in main clauses. We're talking about main clauses or main sentences, the main sentences that can stand on their own and they move the discourse along. The other one would be to ask a question, to raise a question. The subjunctive mood can be used in verbs that ask questions, often called, grammars often call it a deliberative subjunctive. That's true if the subjunctive is not necessarily asking for information. For example, sometimes you might be at a loss in a situation and say, what do I do? And you're not necessarily asking someone to give you information. It's just an expression of deliberation. What do I do? You often find that. Sometimes you'll find the subjunctive used in situations where the question does get an answer or is asking for information. But Matthew chapter 11 and verse 3 is an example of what is often called the deliberative subjunctive, or a subjunctive used to ask a question. And chapter 11 and verse 3. And this is a response to John the Baptist. And it says, and he said to him, to John, are you the one coming, or should we expect another? The verb is pros. Dacomen. Should we expect? So are you the one who is coming? Are you the Christ? Or should we expect another? In this case, it does appear that he's asking for information, because in the next verse, Jesus answered and said to him. John the Baptist's interaction with Jesus. So here's an example of, and the Greek New Testament punctuates it like a question as well. That will be your key. By the way, as a little aside, the punctuation in the Greek New Testament was not put there by the New Testament authors. Hopefully you know that. It was put there by the editorial committee that put together your Greek New Testament, the UBS text or Nestle Aland, or the couple other texts as well. The SBL text online, or the text based on the Tregelis by the Tyndale House in Cambridge, England. The punctuation that you find in these texts were not placed there by the authors, original authors of the New Testament, but they are still reasonable, and they should still be your starting point. You should still accept them. They're not just placed there indiscriminately. It's not just people going through and punctuating the text for the fun of it. They have reasons for doing so. But you often, in this case, you'll find Matthew 11:3. Again, let me put the passage. Matthew 11:3. You will find it punctuated as a question that John the Baptist is asking Jesus: Are you the one who is coming, the Messiah, or should we expect another? So this would be an example of what is often called a deliberative subjunctive. In this case, it is asking for information, but it's a main verb in the form of a question. The other function of the subjunctive, that both of those, the hortatory subjunctive and what is often called the deliberative subjunctive, are the use of the subjunctive in main clauses. The use of the subjunctive in supporting or subordinate clauses, or I like to call them secondary clauses, There's a number of important functions. Again, I just want to focus on some. One of them is in subordinate clauses introduced by conjunction such as hinna, which again usually will indicate purpose or result. So a clause introduced by hinna will have a verb in it in the subjunctive mood, and it will usually indicate purpose or clause. Sometimes hinna can show content. It can also sometimes you'll have a statement like, I pray hinna, followed by a subjunctive verb. And the hinna may express the content of the verb, not so much the content of praying, not so much the purpose. So that's a possibility as well. But the point is that the subjunctive mood will be used in clauses introduced by hinna, which would be a subordinate clause. Another one is clauses introduced by hatan would be another one. Hatan is a temporal clause, meaning whenever. And the verb in the clause that follows it would be in the subjunctive mood. And then another very common one is eon, which introduces a conditional clause. We'll talk in the next lecture about conditional clauses in more detail, but we've already seen the indicative mood can be used in conditional clauses introduced by a, epsilon iota. Now, the subjunctive mood can also be used in conditional clauses introduced by on. And again, we'll talk about what's the difference between that and an indicative mood conditional. We'll see there's actually four possible conditional constructions in Greek, and we'll talk more about those. But all I'm doing now is just demonstrating how the subjunctive mood can be used. It can be used in subordinate clauses introduced by, these are three of the more common ones, introduced by hinna, introduced by hatan, and then introduced by eon. Those all introduce subordinate or dependent clauses. One other function of the subjunctive mood, it can also be used in indefinite clauses, which will often have alpha nu, the on, in it. And that just adds an idea, the notion of indefiniteness. And we'll look at some examples, especially of on, later on. But there are numerous examples throughout the New Testament. And the thing is, these first three will always come first in a clause. And so whenever you see these, you should think two things. Number one, here comes a subordinate clause, a supporting clause. And number two, here comes a subjunctive verb. These have their own meaning, but you can also kind of treat them as signals that a subjunctive verb is coming up in a supporting or subordinate clause. So that's the use of the subjunctive verb, and we'll pick up a couple of these in the next lecture as well. And again, the subjunctive verb used in both main clauses and also supporting clauses. Then the last one in this lecture that we want to deal with is the optative mood. As I've already said, the optative mood is fairly rare in the Greek New Testament. I think there's less than 70 usages in the entire Greek New Testament of the optative verb form, a verb in the optative mood. And the most common functions of the optative in the New Testament Again, you won't find very many of them. It's interesting. A lot of when I learned first year Greek, the optative mood endings were kind of in a footnote or in an excursus at the end of the chapter, because again, you know, there's less than 70 usages of the optative mood that, you know, what's the likelihood of finding one or coming across one in the New Testament? There's basically the way to look at the optative mood, there's basically two categories. One of them is what grammars call volitive, or usually this is the use of the subjunctive in wishes or prayers. This is probably the category under which you will find, you would place Paul's famous me genoita. Again, different translations translated differently. May it never be, or I think the King James, God forbid. It's a strong negation, a strong way of saying this shouldn't happen, this should never be. But you often find this as you often find this again in other sorts of wishes. For example, in 2 Thessalonians 3:16, and may the Lord of peace himself give you peace through everything or in every way. And notice the verb is doe. That is the subjunctive of didomi. And again, this comes from 2 Thessalonians 3:16. But this, again, this is the use of the subjunctive in a wish or a prayer. May the Lord. And often you translate it, you'll use the word may. But the idea, remember, of the optative, the action is seen as potential. It's seen as a projection, like the subjunctive, but with more contingency, with more hesitancy. So that fits very well with the use of the optative in wishes or prayers. And again, the most famous one that occurs, that's over. I think there's 14 of them, so that's a large percentage of the less than 70 subjunctives. Over 14 are the me genoita in Paul's letter. So if you remember that one, you've got most of the subjunctives learned already, and the rest of them, you know, you'll find scattered throughout the New Testament. And then the other one, the other usage besides the volitive is simply what grammarians often call just the potential optative, the optative mood just used of action that is seen as potential or possible, with the added idea of contingency, which is part of the meaning of the subjunctive. So for an example, this comes from Luke chapter 15, verse 26. And having summoned one of the servants, he inquired what these things might mean or what they might be. And here you have on and a, which is the optative of a me. And notice this particle that is used to add and reinforce the contingency. But this is just a statement demonstrating the action is potential, and the optative mood with on used to indicate that. So again, I don't want to go into any more detail on the optative. It's best just to deal with them when you see them outside of the me genoita, which will take care of 14 of the less than 70 uses of the optative in the New Testament, and the others can be probably put in one of these categories of a prayer or a volitive, either prayer or wish, or just making a potential statement.
This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on third semester of New Testament Greek. This is session number 10 on mood.